Why is lipidomics relevant in obesity and neurology? Does it make sense to monitor dietary interventions with lipidomics? And what is the benefit of exploring sex differences in precision medicine? In this episode, Christina Lejido Quigley answers all of these questions and more as we discuss her work and its impact on research and health. Welcome to Season 4 of the Metabolomist Podcast, where we explore the transformative role of metabolomics and multiomics in advancing the principles of 5P medicine. That is predictive, preventive, precision, population-based, and participatory medicine. I am your host, Alice Limonciel, and this year I will engage with leading scientists and entrepreneurs to uncover how integrative omics strategies are set to revolutionize medical research and also patient care. Join us as we delve into the latest innovations and challenges at the intersection of metabolomics and 5P medicine, shaping the future of research in health. Welcome to the Metabolomist. Today I'm joined by Christina Lejido Quigley. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thank you very much for joining and for being the first guest in this season's podcast. For the people who don't know you, I'd like to introduce who you are and the work that you do. I know that you have a double affiliation to organizations in the UK and in Denmark, maybe more. Can you explain to us where you work and what is the core of your work?
I'm working most of the time at the King's College in London, where I'm currently in systems medicine. And then one day a week on Fridays, I'll work in a hospital called Stenodiabetes Center. And this hospital is based in Copenhagen. And I work virtually on Friday.
And so do you have the same activities at both institutions? Because I know your work is very focused on lipidomics, metabolomics, and different diseases.
Yes. Well, in King's, I have the activities of an academy, which is a lot of activities from the teaching, administration, and research. And then, yes, now research is lipidomics, metabolomics, and the data that we use. So before that, I was 6 years in the hospital. And during those 6 years, we have had a lot of projects. We were able to gather a lot of data. So we are still crunching the data. Mm-hmm. And that's what I do on the Fridays. Like I meet with members of my team that were there, and it's really science and brainstorm.
Mm-hmm. And so the world of metabolomics, lipidomics has very broad expertise. So can you tell us a bit where you come from initially? Is it more the clinical side, or the biology, or the chemistry, or bioinformatics?
Yeah, my first training was analytical chemistry. And I started working with the first with HPLC, and then mass specs as well, and I realized I like a lot of these instruments. And then I went for an interview at the Department of Analytical Chemistry at the Imperial. So that was in chemistry as well.
Mm-hmm.
And
at this time, so the mid-90s, late-90s, metabolomics was just beginning, right? Do you remember then your first contact with lipidomics? Because I think you use lipidomics more than metabolomics, right?
It wouldn't be more. Yeah, so when I was in the PhD, we were in the chemistry building. And next door, there was the medicine building. And there we had a professor studying, whose name was Jeremy Nicholson. And he brought a lot of NMRs with him. So I knew of him because of the NMRs being on the pitch floor. So that's the time that I heard that there were people doing metabolomics.
They're just next door to the birth of metabolomics.
I think the birth was before that. When I finished the PhD, I did a postdoc in Italy, which was not metabolomics, for a year. And then I came back to Imperial, and then I was working with Jeremy and also Elaine Holmes. They had got the first UPLC-MS for metabolomics. It was a beta version of the instrument.
Mm-hmm. And then, did you first play with the analytics, or did you directly apply to certain exploring certain diseases, or like what was your entry point to the application?
So I was working with the clinicians of liver disease.
Mm-hmm.
So I was starting with plasma and doing a bit of NMR and then also mass spectrometry and trying to understand it a little bit, the molecules that we were seeing with each technique.
Mm-hmm.
And doing annotations because it was quite difficult. Basically, we would be more like, we need to add some standards and make sure that we see these things.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time, have a lot of features. But we were not calling features at the time, like things that we couldn't annotate.
Yes, yes. You use these omics to usually to describe a certain disease state or to look at the effects of different interventions. So, for example, in the two papers we're going to discuss later in the episode, we're going to talk about obesity and Alzheimer's. How do you choose the diseases you work on? Is it a matter of just how the collaborations work out and then you're brought into different topics? Or do you choose to focus on more metabolic disease and Alzheimer's? And actually, what drives you to choose certain topics and projects?
The Brazilian postdoc, actually, I was able to choose because Lynn did the proposed three different projects. And then when she said about this clinical liver disease and like this, it was like amazing. I always wanted to like work in medicine together with chemistry. I saw it a bit more like an application. I think when I started as a lecturer at the King's, after only 1 year after this postdoc, it was a little bit survival, really. It's just because, but at that point, I didn't have a respect. And you would say, if some people would propose something and then they had instrumentation or. So I ended up doing a lot of different things, which is interesting. Like somebody would say, you want to do heavy racing? Yeah, why not?
Mm-hmm.
So you want to do science?
So do I get it right that you honed the methods and then you collaborate with different people and apply the analytics that you've developed?
At that point, it was like that because I didn't have a lot of choice.
And have you found that lipidomics was particularly interesting for certain diseases and maybe less for others?
After almost 20 years since I started my position in King's, and then I honed more into still liver disease and metabolic syndrome and then also Alzheimer's disease, it's more obvious that it will be useful for metabolic syndrome or for a steatotic liver.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's maybe more original to have a look in Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm. And you did find very interesting things in there. So we will talk about this a bit later in the episode. But I think originally people were tempted to use lipidomics for diseases where lipids are known to drive or like to be strongly associated with the disease. But also for Alzheimer's, I think the main genetic predisposition known is linked to lipoproteins and the transport of lipids. So it does make sense to look there, right?
It does, yeah. I think you're referring to ApoE.
Yes.
Yeah. But I also got a bit of backlash at the beginning because of genetic lipids. I remember in a conference like confronted by scientists telling me, why are you looking at lipids? Like if it was like a lesser.
Interesting.
But I was looking at that, right? Like, what are you looking at? Maybe it was like,
have you heard those omics?
And then after I found out that the brain is like mostly made of lipids.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So it's like, 60% of the dried weight of a brain is
lipids. Mm-hmm. And those lipids have to come from somewhere.
They must be doing something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now we'll dig deeper into the Alzheimer's story. But so before we look into the papers in more detail, we wanted to also discuss together the place of women in STEM. And this was I know this is a topic that's dear to you. So you've been a woman in the scientific world for a few decades now. So what aspects would you like to put forward?
Sometime ago, maybe 20 years ago, when I was seeing the conferences, especially the ones that are more analytical chemistry or data science, actually, there wouldn't be any women speakers. I was thinking, okay, let's try and make a list, and then I can share the list with people, and then they can see the names of women in the field, and they can invite them to these conferences. Mm-hmm. Or to
because this is often a response when you point out that there are no women in the room, is that, yeah, but if they were so good, they would be known and then they would be automatically invited. And I guess this is a way to respond to that, to show that there are women who are already doing the work and that they could be part of the group, right?
And then I did this list, and I think I made it just as a Google Doc, so people mm-hmm. could actually edit themselves the list. And at some point, I also organized it by countries, because it was a bit more organized. So that's still available on my webpage. And anybody can go in and add themselves for update, right? Where they add the base to the book country. But I think it was quite successful. A lot of people have asked it for the list, and then other mm-hmm. people that have done much bigger and organized groups, but they told me that they were gonna use it like the banner in US. And now I think in our field, it seems the ratio of of speakers in conferences. Unless some cases when I have a look and I think, okay, but I think it's good now in comparison mm-hmm. to maybe the 20 years ago.
Yeah, there's been some progress for sure. Are there other aspects of, a scientist's life or things like this where you would put now the efforts? Let's say the list now is working and people are aware of it and using it. There's something else that you hope for us as a society, as a community, that we will build in the coming year?
In academia, which is maybe what I know a bit more, would be the problem of women leaving what I think they call attrition.
At a certain age, especially.
Yeah, but it's a widow from almost 50-50 at undergraduate level and at master's level. Mm-hmm. And then as years go by, a lot of women either leave for industry, which is a totally fine, or leave science altogether, which maybe is not so fine if they don't want. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is a problem that exists currently, and it doesn't seem to be getting better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and despite the imbalance that this causes, it's also a pity, because usually women leave at a time when they've achieved like such experience and such knowledge that they would be really useful parts of the community. And there are many reasons why women leave around their late 30s, 40s, something like this, maybe a bit earlier for multiple reasons, usually private reasons, but also maybe difficulties to just stay in the working environment where they are. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree. This is somewhere where we could really do something. Do you know of any activities that are working towards this or different organizations?
I haven't seen anything really that it has excited me a lot. I think maybe 5 years ago, what I did, it was all of these like, women have to be inspired by other women, which is, I don't mm-hmm. think, so much the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Or women have to be more confident, which is also not the way to go.
I mean, it's one aspect, but the system has to be more supportive and maybe more another angle. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe it could be more systematic. I have this friend from Korea who was telling me that in academia in Korea, it's like Okay, so you are 5 years. After 5 years, then you get promoted to this. And then after 5 years, you get promoted to this.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, we are all working. We're all working a lot. Yeah. So why make it so complicated? No, it's a...
So, yeah, that's an example, yeah. But I would say so. Maybe let's put out a call if there are any people working on activities or have ideas on how to influence this. Maybe they can get in touch with you, and you can also get in touch with me. I don't mind.
Yeah, no, definitely. And Bent from the National University of Singapore. I don't know if you have interviewed her, but she's...
I've tried. I keep trying.
She's great. I mean, she's done so much with the FEMS. The females in mass spectrometry, and they organize so many things, and they do the things that are really good, like training on leadership, and not so much like you need to be inspired, you need mentors.
So exactly, the mentorship program. Maybe that's one point we can go to. So, do you think mentorship is the way to go? For example, at the individual level and also as a group.
I think mentorship is one of the ways, yes. It can be very good to know the inside of how things work and get help and advice. If mentorship is good, it's marvelous.
Mm-hmm. I would say that's advice for anyone, probably at any stage in their career, but especially at the beginning, it can be really helpful to get supports and guidance from someone who's in a place where you wish to be in the next few years. If anyone has ideas on how to progress this topic, I think both of us are happy to hear about it. So come to us. But I think we're ready to dive into the two papers we wanted to talk about today. We chose two because they were looking into different diseases and both showing very interesting results, I think. So the first one is focused on obesity in children and teenagers. It's from 2024 with Yun Wang as the first author, published in Nature Medicine. And so I just say the title, but for anyone listening, you will have the link to the paper so that you can check it out either while you listen or afterwards. So it's titled Lipid Profiling Identifies Modifiable Signatures of Cardiometabolic Risk in Children and Adolescents with Obesity. And so we've discussed a bit how you get to studying certain diseases, the lipidomics. And this is, of course, obesity is one of the ones where lipids are known as either a culprit or at least an associated factor of the disease. But do you want to maybe guide us to what you were hoping to achieve with this study, what you were looking into specifically, and maybe also why children and teenagers specifically?
The idea was for the first time to have a look in a very big cohort of children and try to do an intervention, which is the one they do in this hospital. It's called the Holbeck method, because the hospital is called Holbeck.
Mm-hmm.
And then do this trial and see for the children that lost weight, how this lipido changed with losing weight. And it was a well-studied cohort, so we got a lot of data that we were able to compare the lipid families.
It was over 900 obese children compared to 373 normal weight children. So yes, quite a number. And then what did you find out then?
So in this cross-sectional comparison, we annotated around 300 something lipids. Mm-hmm. And the main results were to do with the cerebrates that were associated to some of the symptoms or complications from obesity that the children had.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, it could be like a high blood pressure, more like a cardiovascular related complication.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we also saw is that sphingomyelins were the opposite. So the more healthy, the more sphingomyelins the children would have. So as you said,
because I know this is something we'll discuss in the second paper, I know that sphingomyelin levels are quite different between women and men. Did you check to see if this effect on the sphingomyelin was different in this study between females and males?
We didn't see it as clear in this, because we did compare the birth and the girls. I think maybe because of the metabolic changes in children and we had from right young to almost teenagers. So it was more variable in the physiology.
Yeah, and it's a more clearly metabolic disease than Alzheimer's, which is the topic of the second paper. Sorry, please continue.
But there was an overlying disease that as the children were growing with age, we saw the lysophospholipids increasing. That was also a very clear result. That would be the main result.
And what I found particularly interesting in this paper was the intervention. There's something I'm really interested in because so if we talk about obesity or metabolic syndrome, clearly labeled metabolic diseases, where we expect that diet and lifestyle are going to be one of the main drivers of the onset and the progression of the disease, then it's really interesting to try dietary or other lifestyle interventions and then using lipidomics or metabolomics to follow the progression to see if we see those factors changing. And this is what you did in the study. Yeah. So you had them follow this intervention for obesity management. And then you, what did you find there?
When they did this heartbreak method for 1 year, not all of the children lost. I shouldn't be saying the weight because we were looking at a standardized BMI for children. It's a little bit difficult, you know, also because children grow so much in 1 year. And to say like they're going to lose the weight, it would be complicated. They have this standardized BMI, so we were looking at this. And yeah, what we could see is that the overall profile of these main families that they always tell you about, so the cerebral sphingomyelin, the lysophospholipids, they were becoming more healthy or more like the...
They're going towards the control process.
Yes.
So this was probably comforting, I guess. The clinicians they were working with must have been happy about those results.
Yes, and then we did a lot of looking at these lipids and how they were associated with the risk of the cardiometabolic disease. How this risk would change with having less of the ceramides.
If I can ask a methodological question, so especially for people who are maybe not so familiar with lipidomics, because we have a lot of audience who's more into metabolomics, like into the small molecules. And I always try to have some episodes on lipids so that they can get familiar with the concept a little bit. So, for example, so far we've been talking about classes of lipids, like ceramides, like phospholipids, where you can have dozens or hundreds of single molecules that are going to be part of a pool. So when you do the analysis, like physically and analyzing the sample, do you have a single strategy to create your lipidomic profile? Like you're going to use this methodology and you're going to have this level of resolution of the species or the molecules that you're measuring? Or do you adapt your strategy based on the study design?
We adapt.
Yeah. So what are the key factors that make you choose one thing rather than another? Can you elaborate a bit?
Yeah, we always try to have a better met within the time frame of the project.
So I guess the time frame is both like the time frame of the project and also the measurement time for each sample, which can get quite high if you want to look at many lipids. Because there's a lot of choice in lipidomics.
Yes.
So do you have ways to reduce the measurement time, for example, or like to make it efficient-ish?
For this project, we didn't reduce the measurement time. Actually, we made it longer. because we decided to run our untargeted lipidomics. We also have a targeted one.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, we did the untargeted. And so from there, we have different software that we can use to extract the peaks and then see them. The name of the little, and we moved to Skyline, which we hadn't used before, and it was because we could see the catching of the peaks better.
Okay,
it was slower.
Yeah,
but you can actually see the retention time. I should have this mass, or I should have this transition, and then you can check it on the software. It's easy to check and to correct if the peaks have moved a little bit and it's not that big anymore, or it has a strange shape. Or
but then at the end in your data set, you have molecules like, I don't know, if we think of the phospholipids, for example, where they're going to have several fatty acid chains. Like, what level of resolution do you go for?
For this one, we didn't go to the fatty acid chain resolution, but the sum of the...
Yeah. What's the advantage of going there? Is it then reducing the measurement time or the analysis time maybe? Or what's the added value of simplifying the structure?
You would need the MSMS to see the fatty acids.
Mm-hmm.
It is faster.
So at certain times we don't have things available, but looking back, would you have gone directly targeted now for this study or for similar studies? Or are there still options where you would rather go untargeted and other times where you would rather go targeted?
Targeted is really good once you have set up a method and took a good year of a super expert to do it. And you do that on a cheaper plot, like on a good top.
High resolution, yeah.
And then it's really good data. We are actually writing the paper now.
Okay.
But also, if you're not going to see, or you will not have the opportunity of checking other peaks.
It's always the trade-offs, yes.
So I would do untargeted sometimes. Mm-hmm.
But for lipids, so especially when we will have, where we're going to look for specific molecules, like specific lipids. But very often for lipidomics, people want to see how the class behaves, like we did now. For example, the ceramides are higher in obese children and they're decreased with the intervention. So in cases like this, I guess most of the time, especially if we're not looking for a specific molecular interaction with an enzyme or something like this, probably either approach where you look at the class without going into too much detail would anyway be informative, because you look at a movement of a group, so you don't have to have necessarily every individual in the group to follow that movement. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think there is a value on those. And actually, the biology of the lipids, we really don't understand so much, the steps of how the lipids are put together, or what comes first, or what comes later on.
And when you interpret the result, what place do you give to the fatty acids and the lipids that are absorbed from diet? Because we absorb a lot of fatty acids and also of complex lipids that break down and that get glued back together. So do you ever try to think of what is the direct contribution of diet versus what metabolism is going to do?
It depends on the study. The clinical trial could have some diet information, although it went for 1 year. I'll tell you one interesting study that I'm actually looking at to explain. And this was a clinical trial where people were given a lot of alcohol. And he was...
the same study these days.
He was... everybody was queuing for the road. And then we did a clinical trial. And it was very interesting because we did the lipidomics the next 3 hours before and after the drinks. Mm-hmm. And then we could just see how the livers that they were healthy we're actually making this enormous amount of the triglycerides stripped away in the blood. And then they were absorbing like you were saying, so fatty acid. But also they were absorbing the lysophosphocholates, which that I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
So that they were also used to make the triglycerides.
Mm-hmm.
So this would be like one of these diets in a way, right? That mm-hmm. that you can see in real time. Which
so either do you have a preference between like plasma and serum for lipidomics?
We're using more plasma.
Okay. There are lots of lipids, as you mentioned, in the brain. There can be lots of lipids in the liver and other organs, and of course, adipose tissue. So have you ever done that exercise of comparing the different tissues, or do you have any interesting experiments you did, maybe comparing blood to tissue in different contexts?
We have many tissues. My PhD student, Nawra Sari, she was the
acid
student.
Yeah.
I think.
Okay.
And at that point, we were wondering about adipose tissue.
Yeah.
This was in Denmark. Mm-hmm. And then she was like, oh, I have a friend, and she was in a clinic, and they're doing this, how do you say when you take the fat of the body?
Liposuction.
Exactly.
Whoa. That's a dream.
And I was like, what are you going to do? Are you going to wait outside
with your Tupperware box?
Make sure you get Essex. And she did get a lot of tissue. Mm. And so we started comparing different areas of the liposuction. Mm. And then we realized how the adipose tissue was very different. If it was from the thighs, the tummy, the breast. When we published, the story was that we considered the profile on the thighs more healthy than the adipose tissue we had found in the trunk.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because it has more phosphocholines, more like what you would imagine in HDL or something like this.
I see. Okay. Okay, so we've been a bit deviating towards other things. We're still related to obesity or at least like adipose tissue. Before we move on to the Alzheimer's paper, are there other aspects of the publication we've been discussing so far you'd like to put forward? I'm always especially interested in many challenges that you had to go through, like from the study design to the measurements and all the steps.
When we first submitted the paper, are you sure you will? When we do the data analysis, we start by the simplest kind of data analysis we can do, which is like looking at associations between lipids and the clinical outcomes and seeing what's increased, decreased, or what's significant. And then maybe looking at correlations as well. But then when we submitted this week to Nature Medicine, we got three reviewers with comments additional, like data analysis to the paper.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant that if we wanted to satisfy the reviewer, we would have to do what 4 times the amount of data analysis that we had done, like,
mm-hmm.
on the first group.
How did you handle that?
It was a lot of extra hours and weekends. But yeah, so the first one that always like worries me a little bit, and I guess this happens to a lot of people when they publish, is that for a start, we have a lot of molecules that we look in many comparisons, right? So then you have to start doing some of the statistical techniques to account for that.
Yeah.
So then if another reviewer comes in and says, okay, now do all of these other comparisons because I find them interesting. Uh-huh. And maybe I also find them interesting. But then you're changing all of the results of the paper.
Yep.
It's not like your additional comparisons. Yeah. But then what we did is to to correct sensitivity analysis. So you almost like do a block and say, okay, these are the things that now you asked. I'm not going to change your own analysis. So let's do this sensitivity analysis where we look at the particular things. So that's one of the maybe tricks. Then the other one who were like asking for machine learning and prediction, again, super interesting, but it could be a whole other paper because there were so many outcomes. So then we had to decide for what we considered the most interesting outcome, which was the amount of fat in the liver, and to try to pair with the lipids in circulation with an algorithm. And also we had to choose one algorithm because you could choose many different machine learning algorithms. So we did that, the minimum. And then for the other one, which was a mediation analysis, and that was quite interesting, and that actually we decided to do almost all of the results and see which of the lipids could have an inferred causality on the cardiometabolic complication.
Now it's becoming more and more difficult to publish without doing any sort of mediation analysis or Mendelian randomization. Like, this is becoming, it's really valuable to add causation or an idea of causation to association is really something that you can't say no to if it's feasible. So it makes sense, I guess, that this was required, but it's a lot of work, right?
Yes, it was a lot of work, but I agree it was a good idea. And then after this paper, actually, we have another paper which just came out in January, where we do some of the Mendelian randomization with the group that has all the genetics knowledge, which is the interventions in this case, or in the paper.
So, did you find additional insights to what we discussed now? Adding the genetics?
Yes.
Did you refine the lipidomics?
Yeah. So
finding.
So one of them would be that the ceramides were causally inferred to liver disease in this case. There would be one of those from the follow-up. And for that, because it's the work of Bob Yam, she actually utilized a very good resource, which is Peter Merkey has done in the Baker. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but he has our Ryan's webpage where he's done lipidomics on thousands and thousands of patients, and he has learned the GWAS, so the CWAS or the so from all the genes associations to the lipids with his method. And it's freely available and you can play with it and it's
That's really interesting, thank you. Okay, then so the second paper we wanted to discuss today is one that you've just submitted to MedArchive. So by the time people listen to this podcast, at the very beginning, it will still be on MedArchive, but like eventually it would be on another platform with the journal that you submitted to. But so the first author is Asger Retlin, and the title is Lipid Profiling Reveals a Deficit of Lipids with Unsaturated Fatty Acids in Women with Alzheimer's Disease. And so this is a very interesting combinations of insights for me. So we've discussed a little bit Alzheimer's disease, we've discussed a little bit that there are differences in lipid profiles between women and men. I've mentioned sphingomyelins, but there are many others that are known. And one known risk factor for Alzheimer's disease is the mutation or different types of mutations in the APOE4 gene. So I guess all those things came into play for you to look into this study. So can you tell us a bit about the context of the study and what you found out?
So for Alzheimer's disease, we've been looking quite a few years and looking at the finding phosphocholines with omega fatty acids being decreased. With Alzheimer's disease, we showed this like a good 10 years ago already. And this is a result that that first we saw like in 50 patients, and then we were able to see 200, and then we were able to have a look in longitudinal also cohorts, and it validated and it validated. And then in this last paper, we had this cohort with the 1,000 patients from a cohort in the King's College London. And we did, again, our latest epidemics because we are always trying to do a better method with more lipids and more accurate. And when we started doing the analysis, we were already planning on now stratifying by sex to see the differences. And then, yeah, we were actually quite shocked that what we had seen over and over, it was actually driven by women, and we hadn't checked.
And I think so there are many such cases, but yeah, it's good this checked because, please, yeah?
No, I'm saying like this, trying to find an excuse for this, but also before we didn't have such a big cohort as this was.
Yeah, but I think you're far from being alone in like more recently discovering these differences. This is something that's coming out now because we separate more and more women and men results. And for metabolomics and lipidomics, it's really important because there are massive differences for certain analytes. Others are going to be very comparable, and certain are going to be, especially with lipids, they have entire classes that are going to be higher in women and others that are going to be higher in men. And I think it's great you found this difference, because for me, it's not just interesting on a fundamental level, although it is fascinating, but it's also very important when we think of developing therapies against Alzheimer's or to prevent Alzheimer's. So do you know what are the implications of this difference for example, pharma companies or clinical research?
There is the obvious thing of now knowing that women and in the also women with MCI, which is mild cognitive impairment, they start having less of the unsaturated fatty acids in the lipids, to the point that it's much less when women are diagnosed with dementia. So what we know for sure is that supplements, so not for dementia, sorry, but also, but we know for as in you would have like a supplement with omega fatty acids, and we know that they are incorporated, and then you would have many more lipids with unsaturated fatty acids.
So you see them first in the blood when they're absorbed, and then you start to see them appearing more in tissues where they would be incorporated in the lipids that make the membranes or that make the adipose tissue.
Exactly. And that we have done the use of clinical trials where we have given the supplements and look at the phosphocholines before and after. And both women and men incorporated in the same amount. So that was there was not that a difference.
But so here, should we make a clinical trial with women and men, or should we look at that for women and then do something different for men? Because that might not be as relevant for the men who will develop dementia and Alzheimer's to look into the unsaturated fatty acids.
Well, the problem with doing clinical trials for Alzheimer's is that they need to go on for a long time. Right? So not 5 years, 10 years. So there's already like a problem in identifying people that are at risk of Alzheimer's. So we are, this is a bit of, you know, like a catchy 22. So that's kind of the work that we are also doing, right? This could already be at risk. If you are a woman and you start by having very, very low unsaturated fatty acid, and then in my mind, there will be other things that they could be part of this risk, like the hormones. if you are in your 50s, let's say, or with the ApoE4, that's another risk if you happen to be
in the carrier. But so do we know, speaking of hormones, so whether it's the typical sexual hormones or others, like, do we know that they influence lipid metabolism to a large extent, and that they could be, for example, in when you, people and women near menopause time, that the decrease of certain hormones could slowly lead to the effects we see in lipids? Is there any indication of that?
Not yet. The change in hormones would make these unsaturated fatty acids or differences.
Mm-hmm.
But for sure that there is a remodeling of the lipids during the after the menopause or even premenopause. Yes, that's mm-hmm. that's no. And even the what I was telling you when we were doing this study about side adipose tissue versus trunk adipose tissue. So this is what also happens, right? When we were all of a sudden put the much more adipose tissue the trunk.
Yeah, and so it's qualitatively it's a different adipose tissue.
Yeah, it's different composition of lipids.
Mm-hmm. And also something that people often forget is that lipids are mediators of many signals. So they are ligands to receptors and things like this. So it's not only a structural difference when you have different lipids in a tissue, it's also going to have signaling consequences, right?
Yes, definitely. It's and that the lipids are hormones themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. With this result of in women, it would be good to follow up, maybe with a clinical trial, something more specific, but it won't be answered because this is too long, too difficult. So, so you need to find a proxy, something that you can measure, maybe a year, and then say, yes, this is good for the brain. And people maybe try to look at things that are more like biology or biomarkers of Alzheimer's or of neuron. It could be something like amyloid in the brain, BDNF. And these things now can be also measured in plasma.
Yeah, it's only the beginning because your study is just coming out, like barely coming out at the
moment. Not even accepted.
Yes. But we'll see the impact of this in the coming years. Without thinking of Alzheimer's, take especially omega-3 supplements is a very, very common one. So maybe there's something there also to be done with less systematic clinical trials and more like longitudinal cohorts that have people who already are taking supplements and just seeing if you can find an association there that could also be a way to have some deeper insights before the longer longitudinal study is finished.
What is interesting about the omegas or the very high unsaturated fatty acids, it's that if you look at population level, they always come up as not having enough is like a risk of of disease. And you see that very much in the UK Biobank with the 500,000 mm-hmm. people. And the biology is really not well understood. Most clinical trials until now will not be possible.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at just giving omegas and then looking at cognition changes, as an example, mm-hmm. they need to be designed in the precision medicine way. Maybe stratify women that have actually very, very low amounts. Mm-hmm. And not only the omegas, but now maybe these analytics that we have also found.
Yeah.
The ones that are changing the most with the less cognition.
Mm-hmm.
And then do another group, which is the extreme opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And then now let's do it and you can see the results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, this is also a place where for both lipidomics and metabolomics, I hope that we get to see more of those molecules used in clinical trials and then in the clinics, because all of these molecules are potential biomarkers of whatever event you're looking at. But at the moment, we're still I think we're just at the tipping point before we start implementing batteries of biomarkers that are going to come from those omics. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I'm really looking forward to the time when we really start implementing them. Mm-hmm. Starting to get impatient. So, and maybe a last question on that paper. So we just tried really nice results for women with the decreased unsaturated fatty acid, increased saturated fatty acids in Alzheimer's. What about the men? Was there no change for the men at all?
We also compared the women and men. And so that's where we saw that the women have more skin in general.
Okay.
But not in this study.
Interesting. Very interesting. Thank you. So for this season, we really want to talk about 5P medicine. And actually, we've touched at least four of those in the discussions we've had now in the last hours. We've seen in the first paper, we had nice examples of the use of population-based research, which you do in many of your studies with relatively large cohorts. And the first paper was about a sort of personalized intervention, so like prevention of obesity, reduction of the phenotype, monitoring of the phenotype, and then doing that in a personalized way because the intervention is personalized for each person. So, and then the second one, we go more towards precision in the sense of, you know, what I call like ground zero personalized medicine is women and men. I agree that the most simple way we can go, and then we can start breaking it down into other subjects and going towards the prediction, like early markers of disease, like for Alzheimer's especially, this is really important. And again, this aspect of population. So I think with these two papers, it's really clear that your work is building the foundation of many of the things that are going to happen in the future for medicine. So with these 5P and different approaches on the inspirational kind of vision-driven levels, do you see your work feeding the next generation of medicine? Do you see already the first steps of where your work can help with better biomarkers or other things? And what do you hope is going to be the next steps?
Out of the work that we do, it's progressing to like big cohorts and then discovery of maybe biomarkers or molecules.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other work that we are doing is putting this in the hospital where I also work.
Mm-hmm.
We have now to organize a clinical trial in the FINI with biomarkers. And these are the biomarkers that we have been working on the last 6 years. So basically what we have now is molecules that we know are increased for such complication of diabetes. And it could be cardiovascular, it could be kidney complications. I think these are the two main ones that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and this is why it lasted 6 years, we also have information of what happens to these molecules when you give five different types of drugs. So then we know which drug is going to decrease mm-hmm. this biomarker that is.
So with that, you get like the real life measurements or something where you have the interfering factors that might influence the biomarker level.
Yeah.
You take that into account.
Mm-hmm.
So this is now at the moment of the crunch time
mm-hmm.
where from a number of molecules, and I think I have four candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have the data on how the different type of drugs that the clinicians are giving the patients are changing these drugs. I'm sorry, changing these molecules. And we have to choose one molecule, one complication, and the drugs. And not that's going now into the precision medicine clinic, because there is a precision medicine clinic in the hospital.
Uh-huh. And this is often a question I'm wondering, so especially people who do research, like, how do you bridge that gap? Like, how do you connect to the clinics and to informing clinical trials and maybe driving clinical trials? It's because you have that in your surroundings in the university or the institute where you work?
Yes, this is in the hospital in Copenhagen. It's one of the priorities to do the translational research.
That's great. And are there any other aspects that maybe you were thinking of when we were discussing previously the 5P medicine topic? Is there anything else?
I think, the hopes that maybe we'll find a good framework to do this translation in the clinic easier and more.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think we are adding information of more molecules, which is very useful. But then at the end, this is also information for the clinicians. And also they have the experience of looking at a lot of biomarkers
mm-hmm.
and deciding for the best treatment for a patient.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever try or think of projects where using a broad set of metabolites or lipids and then have an algorithm crunch it to the most interesting ones and then get those to the clinician? Is that also an approach you?
Yes, it's very advanced. It would be ideal. Very, mm-hmm. very clever algorithm. It is happening as well. Like I have a project with a company and they are doing a Raman. And then they don't know what they're seeing because there's not a lot of specificity there, right? So I'm doing at the same time mass spec. And then they're trying to understand what they are seeing with their fingerprints.
Mm-hmm.
And if they happen to be specific for what they want to diagnose, great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think there will be a bit more time for the fingerprints to go through all the FDA, EMA, and
it's quite to use for diagnostic. It's quite difficult to validate. Thank you. So this takes us to our last question, the question everybody is waiting for. What is your favorite metabolite and why? Lipids are allowed, of course.
Okay. let me think. I have a lot of favorite. Maybe the ones that have surprised me more lately could be the sphingomyelins.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would choose a sphingomyelin. I don't really understand them so well, but what I is as a metabolite is very mysterious.
Okay.
Why do I think it will be interesting? Well, first, because they are in neurons and they are protecting neurons and they are helping that we are now thinking a lot. So we have said sunspot in the accents. And then also because I see them as increase for good health. Mm. And also women have more, and I think they give us like a bit of extra protection for some things. Mm. This is not all very scientific, as you guess.
It's just a hunch.
Yeah, it's just a hunch.
But it's an interesting difference between women and men.
And then if you have fibrosis of the liver or you have a very sick liver, they disappear completely from the liver and from the circulation. So I think they also make things like a good healthy liver.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the kind of things that I'm thinking about.
Mm-hmm. From the analytical perspective, is there anything you want to tell us about sphingomyelin? If that's your expertise,
they are not difficult to see.
Hmm.
Like, I would say that the phosphocoryns are also like very, very friendly, but then you can get plasmalogia and stuff like this, which are also phosphocoryns and are extremely unfriendly to see and to measure.
And have you ever found interesting results at the level of the single sphingomyelin, so without looking at the whole class, but do you find some that have specific activities or are particularly elevated or depleted as opposed to the rest of the class?
Yeah, we have seen the differences at the single lipid level, especially when we've been looking at brain with Alzheimer's. But I think I haven't seen it in a systematic way that I can understand what's going on. It's again complicated to the level of the fatty acids. And one thing that maybe it's a new thing that I'm going to go towards a little bit is to have a look at the double bonds in fatty acids, so where they're placed. Mm-hmm. Because you need a technique that either uses oxygen or a reaction with the fatty acids.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that will give more extra complication, but maybe more specificity on what we see.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for sharing your views on sphingomyelin. You're officially now, forever, your favorite metabolite. Mine changes every year, so it's okay to change your mind. Thank you very much. So this is now the end of the episode. So I want to thank you for joining me today, for explaining your research to me and to our listeners, and for generously sharing your views on lipidomics and the beautiful work that you do. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of The Metabolomist, where we uncovered new ways in which metabolomics and multiomics are driving breakthroughs in 5P medicine, the powerful framework that's shaping the future of healthcare. If you enjoyed this conversation and want to stay updated, subscribe to our newsletter at themetabolomist.com to be the first to know when our next episode drops. Until then, I hope you get to keep exploring the fascinating world of metabolomics.